This is a Stimulus Network podcast. Welcome to Eureka Nerd. I'm Leah, a 360-degree threat on account of my flexibility.
And I'm Will, a 360-degree treat.
He's just sweeter than I am.
Hello indeed, and welcome to the show. Thanks for your patience as we took last week out, because the world has been, well, kind of awful.
It keeps basically being stressful out there. Let's go with stressful.
That seems like a polite way of putting it, yes. The world keeps on happening. Whilst the interminable progression and weirdness of 2020 shows no sign of slowing, we've got a few quick stories to try and tide you over and keep you at the very least entertained, maybe even informed, which, on days like the ones we've had of late, informed is an okay thing to be.
And at least half of these are quite optimistic.
Let's open with some research published in the American Journal of Preventive Medicine. Hey, are you doing good?
Yes?
I am glad you are doing good. I'm also glad that you are doing well. What we've got here is a study on how much doing good does you good. And you might think, well, that makes a lot of sense. If you do things for the benefit of other people, you'll probably feel good about it. And you can be philosophical and wax poetic about whether there's any such thing as true selflessness or if anything's done with the intrinsic expectation of being rewarded for your do-gooding.
Yeah, I mean, we've all seen that one episode of Friends, right?
And most of The Good Place.
But according to the results of this study, volunteering as a regular activity as an older person will make you live longer and feel better.
To quote Eric Kim, the lead investigator from the Department of Social and Behavioral Sciences at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health, Boston, humans are social creatures by nature. Perhaps this is why our minds and bodies are rewarded when we give to others. Our results show that volunteerism among older adults doesn't just strengthen communities, but enriches our own lives by strengthening bonds to others, helping us feel a sense of purpose and well-being, and protecting us from feelings of loneliness, depression, and hopelessness. And I think this is something useful for people as a lot of local governing bodies start easing lockdown. You might have had a rough time mentally speaking. A lot of people have. There's a lot of people out there who are having a rough time with many other things. And if your shops, businesses, workplaces aren't reopening and you can volunteer in a safe, healthy, clean way, do consider helping out those who need help. It'll be good for them and, according to this, it'll be good for you.
Now, interestingly, the results didn't show that there was any direct impact on particular conditions or diseases. They mention diabetes, hypertension, stroke, cancer, heart disease, lung disease, arthritis, obesity, cognitive impairment, or chronic pain. But risk of mortality and developing physical limitations in adults over 50 volunteering for about 2 hours a week was significantly reduced.
So, like, we don't know the exact mechanism or any particular disease that it works for, but it just does work, does good for you, you do good, and you get rewarded for it. And it doesn't just have to be you doing good out there. Queensland University of Technology have a press release from May. God, May, that seems so long ago.
That's because it is so long ago.
In the distant, distant past of May, that as governments around the globe move to prop up their ailing economies, a apparently first-of-its-kind investigation could provide important input to employment policy. The input is, do good things to help people, and it'll help people.
Specifically, businesses that are set up as social enterprises are more efficient job creators than purely commercial interests. Which, to be fair, if your goal in setting up a business is not only to make money, does sort of make sense, really, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And we are spoilt for choice, really, with those kinds of companies in Bristol, where we live. Pretty much everything around here is a social venture or a community interest company of some kind of regard. Lots of people
every other business
that
is, yes, some sort of a non-profit. On the other hand, we have the arms dealers. So
There's a quote from Professor Martin Obshonka, who is director of the Queensland University of Technology's Centre for Entrepreneurship Research and its founding director, who says, "Social venture startups are mostly celebrated for their worth in helping the disadvantaged or solving social concerns. Their role in job creation hadn't really been considered. But using an established method for tracking direct and indirect job creation efforts across 67 regions in Sweden over an 8-year period from startup entry to the marketplace, the findings show that the average job creation effect per firm was larger for social startups than commercial counterparts."
They suggest that the mechanisms for that are to do with commercial businesses being started as sole traders whose primary interest is in working for themselves rather than working for someone else. So the motivation to expand and take on other people might not necessarily be there, whereas a social enterprise is built with the specific purpose of helping other people, so expansion is just right there.
If the work is bigger, you need more people to do it, and that makes more work for more people to do. And this should be by no means taken as a looking down on commercial enterprises, especially those that are sole traders, like you say, people working by themselves for themselves. There is absolutely nothing to be said against that. But when it comes to kickstarting a, let's say, regional or national economy coming out of, let's say, a massive recession or a period of lockdown due to a global pandemic, just hypothesizing here, then encouraging social startups, investing in social startups, is, according to this research, going to have much more impact than those of solely commercial ventures, which is good to know.
It's good to know that doing good does good, right?
The truth that will fit into a bumper sticker kind of ring to it. Do good. Feel good. What's good? Goodness.
Everybody loves some goodness.
And our next story is Australian as well, but we're moving on from just doing good. This is something which ties into kind of everything that I've been about for the last 6 or 7 years or so. Science is, in lots of regards, quite good. Some scientists do good, some science improves people's lives. Some scientists are quite good people. The broad public consensus of what a scientist is, especially among children, isn't so good.
This obviously is because it's informed by media portrayals of mad scientists, all white coats and bubbling beakers and mad hair, and I'm not sure if the picture they've got here is actually from Back to the Future or if it's a cosplayer.
It doesn't look quite like actual Back to the Future, does it?
Yeah.
It's just a bit off.
It does sort of look like a cosplayer. I mean, if it is, then props to them. The team led by Dr. Garth Stahl and Dr. Laura Scholes interviewed 45 primary school students aged 9 to 10 years old across 6 economically and geographically diverse schools, asked them about what job they might want to do when they grow up, if they might want to be a scientist, what kind of work they think a scientist does, and what a scientist might look like. And were disappointed, I think, to discover that nearly 40% of students said they didn't like science and that it is boring and weird.
As scientists, I'm sure they were kind of wounded by that. Like, you can't not take a little bit of offence if you've got 4 out of 10 kids telling you you're boring.
And they do note that the children didn't seem to feel that a scientist had to be a man, which is definitely a positive move in the right direction for gender equality in STEM subjects. But they do note that they feel that the notion of science being weird, unusual, dangerous, and challenging could be considered a barrier. Personally, I don't think the problem is that people think science is weird, unusual, dangerous, and challenging. I think the problem is that they think being weird, unusual, and challenging is an inherently bad thing. I mean, you don't get into volcanology because you hate having adrenaline rushes.
There are definitely some specific fields of research and some specific careers that it seems like it's a lot easier to be in if you are a little bit challenging. That's definitely one word for it.
I mean, I'm just thinking of like those that fieldwork fails or fieldwork mistakes hashtag that was around a few years ago. People talking about like accidentally getting scent marked by a leopard and being tracked by them for days.
Gluing themselves to a shark, that kind of thing.
Yeah, you know, like, if we're being honest about what working in science is like, we should be honest about the fact that scientists are scientists because they are huge nerds who are massively enthusiastic about their subjects. And that, depending on your area of research, you might be putting yourself at some sort of a risk. But the payoff is you might learn something that could be very cool, very useful. We're never going to treat scientists like movie stars.
Even in the movies where the star is a scientist doing often quite a lot of running, that seems to be like the scientist movie thing, is you discover that the neutrinos are mutating and the geostorm from Mars is about to turn on all of the Earth's volcanoes due to microwave frequencies or something, and you have to run to a button.
Yeah, and in between that, you're probably like collecting degrees in the style of Tony Stark and Bruce Banner. Actually, Tony Stark didn't do that in the movies, but he definitely did in the comics.
Out of spite, it seemed.
Yeah, I mean, that was a no-prize explanation to fill in for the fact that a writer like hadn't gone through with a obsessive level of concern for the continuity of how many PhDs Tony Stark has right now.
The answer is always going to be more than you anyway, so I don't know why writers even worry about it.
He's also extremely rich.
I wonder how many of his PhDs were bought off the internet.
Anyone who is a Tony Stark fan will be able to, well, actually you about how he's, you know, got integrity and also is actually a massive nerd.
Okay, Marvel stands. You can find us on Twitter at EurekaNerdcast. You can email me directly at EurekaNerdcast@gmail.com. If you think, first of all, is Tony Stark helping the representations of scientists and engineers in media? And how many of his degrees did he buy from the University of Phoenix, Arizona?
I mean, if we're specifically talking about Age of Ultron, he's not helping at all, but like...
Okay, you invent one potentially world-threatening robot, and suddenly the world's, oh, can't trust him. Just because he used to make weapons and still does make weapons and seems to operate outside the law. This is why you get the Sokovia Accords. Anyway, we're getting off the topic here.
On the other hand, Shuri from Black Panther, who is just so extremely cool and competent and very fashionable and has never invented an extremely deadly AI. Or Paul Bettany.
Physical Attraction is the show that explains physics, science, and technology. From the existential threats to humanity, to the impact of technologies on our society, through to the fundamental physics that lies behind it all, we'll take you on a trip through nuclear fusion, neutron stars, artificial intelligence, and quantum mechanics. From interviewing experts to intricately researched narrative episodes, Physical Attraction strives to explain fundamental questions about how the universe works and where the world is going. You can find Physical Attraction at www.physicspodcast.com, on social media as PhysicsPod, and wherever you listen to podcasts. www.physicspodcast.com.
We can move on from this issue of representation in media to one final story, just a quick one, again about representation and media, from the American Society for Nutrition. And this one will not be a surprise to many people, especially those of you listening to this podcast who, let's face it, if we look at the demographics, are going to be probably college educated and are or know men. And this is just the headline here. Playing video games linked with unhealthy behaviours for college men.
Now, they seem to have found a fairly strong correlation in this study between the 40% of college-aged men who play video games at least 5 hours a week consumed more saturated fat and sodium than non-gamers, ate fewer fruits and vegetables, and engaged in less physical activity. However, they haven't found actually any causal link. Most of the press release is written as though they have found a causal link.
If you are eating video games, your PlayStation will surreptitiously inject sodium underneath your toenails or something.
But yeah, they really haven't established why these things correlate.
You feel like there's a dot yet to connect A and C.
There's some things. They're also, I mean, they didn't observe any differences in weight between gamers and non-gamers, but they still talk about future research on this. Might involve following up with participants later in life to reveal whether their habit and body weight has changed. And if the findings of our study are indicative of general population, increases in video game usage could translate to increases in overweight / obesity and chronic disease in the general population. I might have mentioned before, I've got a big problem with linking fatness and health in pretty well any context, but also they're not looking at people who are fat.
Yeah, they have just established that there's no linkage between this unhealthy, quote-unquote, behaviour of consuming more sodium-saturated fats, not doing enough exercise, and not eating enough fruit, and weight. So it seems like health and weight, in their own words and by their own terms, might not be the same thing.
Interestingly enough. So yeah, I think the most important thing they need to do is find out why these things are linked. I'm going to suggest that it may be something like, if you have a video game habit, you might be cooking for yourself less. If you have a video game habit, you are probably not walking around to your mate's house to hang out because you're on voice chat or whatever.
If you are playing more than 5 hours of video games per week, which isn't very much.
It's really like, not a lot.
Super attainable. Then are you also very stressed at college and are using video games to de-stress, and that the stress of college is not only causing you to de-stress with video games, but affecting healthy eating behaviours in a more holistic kind of sense.
Because as we were discussing amongst ourselves the other day, people comfort eat.
And if you're super stressed with college, and I know you're busy at lectures, you've got a bunch of extra stuff going on, you might not even allow yourself time to cook a proper meal. But you can blast out a couple of rounds in Warzone before you go to bed. That's fine. It's easy. It's, you know, a couple of clicks away. Needs further research.
Yeah. And also, you know, it helps not to imply that there is a causal relationship when you absolutely and very specifically have not found a causal relationship.
If you have college-level education and are or know men who did some unhealthy stuff, then...
Oh, boy. Oh boy.
Then let us know what unhealthy behaviours have you witnessed or possibly even committed. Send them to us. Again, that's Eureka Nerdcast on Twitter, eurekanerdcast@gmail.com for emails. You can find us on Facebook as well. And if you want to hear about all the awful things that I've done to myself, my body, and the world around me during my college education, you can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/eurekanerd.
Please note, that is not, in fact, an established Patreon reward tier, but maybe stories of Will being just utterly depraved in Birmingham could be a feature. Let us know if you'd be interested, I guess.
Pictures of me bench pressing a nude student can be yours for the low, low price of like £2 a month or whatever you're comfortable with.
Well, damn, I haven't even seen that one.
For reasons. But until next time. We'll leave you with just a couple more stories to tide you over, because it's a strange, strange world out there, and summer is upon us, so things get weird in the heat. This summer is probably going to be a summer unlike any before it. If you are out in the heat, one, make sure you're wearing a mask to protect yourself and protect those around you.
From the COVID.
From the COVID. And two, from the Faculty of Science, University of Copenhagen, wear a hat.
Because working in the sun, heating of the head may markedly affect safety and performance.
Who'd have thought? Too much heat in the summer on your head. Bad for you. Science. And lastly, let's see what you can make of this.
Sagittal proton density-weighted MRI scans in two 15-year-old female control participants without a distal femoral cortical irregularity demonstrate measurement of the tendon attachment position. Images show the craniocaudal position of the tendon attachment, which is defined as the distance from level of the joint space to the most cranial attachment of tendon slips for the A, medial, and B, lateral head of the gastrocnemius muscle, Note that the tendon of the medial gastrocnemius head shows two prominent tendon slips.
That's right. Skier's knees. All f***ed up. Just like, all f***ed up.
You watch some skiing and you're probably like, oh yeah, that's probably going to put some stress on those knees.
And you would be right. But until next time, that's enough good and rightness from me.
And from me.
Bye-bye.
This podcast is brought to you by the Stimulus Network.
We're queer.
We're geeks.
We're queeks.
Superheroes, Star Wars,
Broadway, Drag Race.
So if you're super gay,
super nerdy,
or anything in between, listen to Queeks today.
Wherever fine podcasts are sold.
And find us on Instagram @QueeksPodcast.